Hawkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can find this show here at American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, as well as on my website, PorkinsPolicyReview.com. And again, you can also tune in Friday nights, 11 to 1 a.m., where it's rebroadcast on a bunch of other networks. Well, today it's going to be me again, going solo, so I guess sit back and take out your notebook because there's going to be a lot of information. And we're going to do kind of a sort of like an update episode. Last week we of course talked about Roger Stone, and that episode got great feedback. So thank you everybody who enjoyed that episode. And of course a big chunk of that episode was spent talking about Al Sharpton, the famous reverend come civil rights activist come MSNBC host, and kind of quite a few emails and comments, people wanting to kind of I mentioned, of course, that Al Sharpton was an FBI informant in that episode, and I linked up to the Smoking Gun article, and I'll put that in the chat room right now, anybody that's interested in kind of following along with that. It's a really great article by William Bastone and a few other writers over at the Smoking Gun. And as I said last week, we talked a lot about the sort of constant reinvention of characters such as Roger Stone, but also a little bit with Al Sharpton. And right now we have the svelte, wealthy Al Sharpton, who was, as I said, a MSNBC commentator. He's, kind of dangerously thin. He looks sort of like a bobblehead figure of himself right now. And he is the liberal crusader, of course, dressed in bespoke suits, very expensive suits. And that is a very different image of the Al Sharpton of the 1980s, who, along with the, track suits and the big gold chains, is very heavy, long kind of hair. And again, very, sort of a loud, very media savvy, so-called civil rights activist. But he was also known by the government as CI-7, Confidential Informant 7. And this started sometime in the early 1980s. And we'll get into that a little bit later, the actual time when Al Sharpton was flipped by the FBI. Now, the general consensus is that this was in 1983, and again, we're going to get into how that all started. And he was basically flipped by now called the Genovese Squad, and this was a joint operation by the FBI and the NYPD that was targeting the Genovese crime family, which was the largest and most powerful mafia crime family in America. And like all confidential informants, Al Sharpton, gathered information. So he was never going to testify in court, and it was never supposed to be revealed that he was CI-7. Now, the Smoking Gun, and this is several years back now. I'll pull up the article, which I probably should have had out earlier. This is April 7th, 2014. William Bastone, Andrew Goldberg, and Joseph Giselli wrote this excellent article, very long, Al Sharpton's Secret Work as an FBI Informant. And I'm basically kind of just ripping off the Smoking Gun here. So, shout out to the Smoking Gun and, of course, to Ed Opperman, who first sort of opened my eyes up to Al Sharpton as a confidential informant. And we'll get into a little bit about what Ed has to say on this. But the Smoking Gun, through FOIA requests with the government, as well as interviews with various members of the Genovese Squad, other law enforcement, court documents, and also some interviews with some of Al Sharpton's more nefarious friends that are in prison, they put together this very comprehensive article outlining Al Sharpton as a CI. Now, we'll get into the specifics of how this all happened, but just as sort of a general overview, Sharpton was flipped at some point, according to The Smoking Gun and others. This was in 1983 during an FBI sting, and after providing a lot of information on his associates in the mafia as well as in the music industry, Sharpton was then sent back, and he famously carried around a customized Hartman briefcase, which was outfitted with a recording device. And Sharpton's information would allow the feds to bug two Genovese social clubs, one of which was owned by the boss, Vincent Chin Gigante, who was a very famous crime boss. He was famous for feigning mental illness, which is the which is a plot line in The Sopranos, of course, with Uncle June. And there's actually, as I was going through this article and doing research, there's quite a few Soprano connections to this that I'll point out as we get on. But along with the social clubs, of course, Gigante's in Greenwich Village, three cars that were used by family leaders, over a dozen phone lines, all these wiretaps were approved during this major racketeering investigation against the Genovese family, and to a lesser extent also the Gambino crime family as well. Excuse me. And eight separate U.S. District Court judges in four federal jurisdictions signed the orders that were based on FBI affidavits, many of which were provided by Al Sharpton himself. Now, it's important to note just sort of straight off the bat that Al Sharpton vehemently denies his history as an FBI informant. Now, he claims that these are mostly smears that were meant to sully his name, and sort of, sway the influence that he had as a civil rights leader. In 2013, Sharpton wrote a book called The Rejected Stone, where he claims that he was actually set up by the government, and then that the agents leaked false information that, quote, could have gotten me killed. Now, he told The Smoking Gun that his cooperation with the FBI was limited to investigations of drug dealing in minority communities and ripping off black artists in the recording industry, which is something that Sharpton has always sort of maintained. That's the extent of his work with the government. We'll get into that a little bit later. Now, he's also denied, of course, being flipped during an undercover operation. When he was asked about this, he was asked about recording of a particular Gambino crime family member, Joseph Pangano, which we'll get into a little bit later. He said, quote, "I'm not saying yes, I'm not saying no." That's what he told The Smoking Gun. And of course, Sharpton has always played the hero card, that this was all this, he was doing all this for altruistic, motivations, that he wasn't terrified of going to jail, that he wasn't trying to save his skin, and that really, you know, what he wanted to do was help get drugs out of the black community and help a lot of black recording artists who were legitimately being ripped off by figures such as Morris Levy, who's a very powerful mafia earner, who we'll get into later, and as well as others we'll get into that. Various mafioso figures. He's now sort of reinvented himself as the trusted White House advisor. He's the, the national black activist leader that Obama goes to. That's his, and he's been to the White House several times. He's obviously now made himself into this liberal crusader. Of course, not paying any attention to his work with Roger Stone, with other conservative leaders, or his work as an FBI informant. And it's important, too, that 60 Minutes did a very big profile of Al Sharpton back in 2011. And this very much kind of framed in people's minds Al Sharpton. The profile was very much about his reinvention, again, as this liberal crusader. He distanced himself from some of the racist, homophobic things that he was known to say in the past. And Leslie Stahl, who was the journalist involved in this, said that there, quote, "there were allegations of mob ties, never proved." And that was sort of the end of that. There were these rumors that had sort of surfaced. And Some of this sort of dates back to a 1988 Newsday report that would say that Sharpton had cooperated with federal investigations against Don King and some organized crime figures. And it was during this time in the late 80s that there was a phone installed in his Brooklyn office in 1987 that was a hotline that went, you know, straight to the – I believe this was the FBI. And that this was there so that Al Sharpton could report on drug dealing. And this was set up by his former FBI handler, Joseph Spinelli, who would also shop Al Sharpton around – because of his knowledge of the mafia. Now, this is I think that is true. He did have this hotline phone, but his sort of pronouncements that that's all it was is kind of a joke, as clearly demonstrated in the Smoking Gun article, which has a lot of great links to all of the documents, so the FBI affidavits, transcripts of some of the wiretaps, all this sort of stuff. But I guess we'll go. Let's go to how this all sort of started, because that's really important understanding this. Now, for right now, we're just going to go with what the Smoking Gun has reported, and then later on, we're going to kind of talk about the exact. There's some discrepancies about when Al Sharpton was actually flipped, but. Let's go back to how the sort of general story of how this happened. So as I said, there's Joseph Spinelli and his partner John Pritchard were involved in some FBI operations. And at one point, they actually got Sharpton secretly recorded with an undercover FBI agent who was posing as a wealthy drug dealer that was trying to get into boxing promotion. So again, we have this connection, Don King, of course, a very famous boxing promoter who manipulated Mike Tyson and a lot of others, very close with Donald Trump, very close with mafioso. So they saw that this might have been a way to get in. Now, people may be familiar with some of with this video. There's of course, Brian Gumbel on HBO Sports played parts of this video, and you can see Al Sharpton with the cowboy hat on, and he's talking with this undercover FBI agent. Now, during one of these conversations, the undercover agent offers to get Sharpton pure coke, 99% pure coke, that he can sell at $35,000 a kilo. Sharpton then nods his head and says, "I hear you." Now, the agent then promised Sharpton a 10% finder's fee if he could arrange a buyer for the coke. Sharpton says that he knows of a buyer, and he says, quote, "If he's going to do it, he'll do it much more than that." And this was also believed, or there's some consensus that they were also trying to target a Genovese soldier by the name of Daniel Pangano. And he was a Sharpton acquaintance, and he was a longtime heroin trafficker. So, you know, there's sort of an in there. Now, while Sharpton never explicitly arranged a deal, and, you know, according to a lot of experts actually watching the tape, it's sort of a bit of a stretch in terms of getting, you know, dirt on him. He never says, yeah, you know, give me the coke and I'll sell it for you, or I'll find a buyer for you. He never really officially says that. Yet, when they approach Sharpton, with this tape and this stuff, he ends up actually flipping. And this, again, FBI files, this is all, there's really no sort of denying this, no matter what the Rev Al will say. Now, Sharpton maintains that when the FBI approached him, that he stood up to them, he dared them to indict and prosecute them, he said that this was entrapment, blah, 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 and that the FBI left. Of course, he never warned his friend, Pangano, that there was a fake drug dealer who was an FBI agent, and the FBI would then open a 137 informant file on Al Sharpton. Now, the FBI was interested in Sharpton for a variety of reasons. As I said, he was very good friends with Don King. And he also had quite a few music connections at that point. Now, particularly James Brown, who Sharpton said was his mentor, and he emulated his style quite a bit with the flashy clothing, jewelry, long hair, cowboy hats, all that sort of stuff. Now, Sharpton had first met and became close with James Brown in the mid-1970s, and it was through Brown that Sharpton would eventually meet a lot of these mafioso and mafia figures. Now, Sharpton actually worked for Spring Records, which was a small record label in Manhattan that was owned by James Brown. And at the time, at Spring Records, there was a Colombo crime family capo, or captain, Michael Franzese, who was also, along with Joseph Bonanno, very famous, who was a Gambino figure, both of which were deeply involved in record production and distribution. The mob used to own a lot of R&B, disco, record companies. They were, you know, people will be familiar with Payola and stuff like that with in terms of getting records played. So he meets Francesi and Bonanno at this point, and it's through these connections that Sharpton was actually involved in a scheme with another Genovese capo by the name of Matthew Matty the Horse Ionello. And they were going to create a sort of front business. They were going to buy up shares in this Con Edison program that was going to offer subsidized electricity to minority businesses. Con Ed eventually shut it down when they figured out what was going on. And the investigation against Ionello and his business partner, who's called Benjamin Cohen, who worked across the hall from Sharpton at Spring Records and recruited him. They were investigated, and, you know, so already now, and this is the late 70s, we start to see that Sharpton is sort of becoming very familiar with some very powerful mafia figures, Bonanno in particular, very powerful guy. And he was involved in some sort of a scheme. Now, Sharpton writes in his first book that the music industry is, quote, is an extremely dirty endeavor because it is a cash business. Music is a street business, and that's where organized crime is, on the street. And it didn't really bother him, and in his book he says that he wanted to learn more about this. So, just to, you know, kind of fill this out right now, we have this guy, Al Sharpton. We have him working at a record label, which is who has a lot of connections to the mafia. We have him involved in some sort of mafia scheme, tricking Con Ed, and we also have him back in 1983, at least, being caught on tape in a coke deal, and at which point he is essentially flipped. Now, a little bit of background. In terms of, Sharpton wanting to get deeper into the music industry. One of Sharpton's mentors in this endeavor was music producer and famed heroin trafficker, Robert Currington. And Currington was an R&B promoter along with legendary radio DJ Frankie Crocker. And they were involved in, again, promoting a lot of very famous R&B singers throughout the 60s and 70s. Now, Currington was caught and acquitted in 1975 on heroin trafficking charges, and then he was then later caught in a 1977 DEA sting. And he, I believe, he at that point pleaded out. He pleaded to having large quantities of mannite, which is a substance which is used to cut heroin. Now, Currington also had a desk job at Cala Records, which was headed by Morris Levy's bodyguard and right-hand man, Nate McCalla. Again, Morris Levy, very well-known record producer. He is actually the inspiration for Hesh in The Sopranos, who is a record producer. And we'll get into some of Morris Levy's claim to fame later. But this guy, Nate McCalla at McCalla Records, was also connected to Michael Francesi, who again, worked, or was associated with Spring Records. And, his father, of course, John, was a Colombo crime family underboss. So Currington was very much acquainted with this world. He knew, he understood this world. He, you know, floated in this world. And interestingly, he also dated Sylvia Roan, who's a very influential female music executive. She headed Elektra Entertainment Group, Universal Motown Records. I think she is still the head of Epic Records, which represents Michael Jackson, Prince, Outkast, Ozzy Osbourne, a lot of stuff. And Sharpton worked under Currington, threatening labels and concert promoters with boycotts and protests unless they put more into the black community and into black artists. And this is a big cornerstone of Al Sharpton's claims of being this crusader for the black community. He was very big about exposing corruption. And, you know, again, Morris Levy was very famous for basically claiming ownership and claiming songwriting credits on songs that he never wrote. And basically ripped off countless careers of mostly young black R&B artists, which again is a major plot line of an episode in the, I think it's the first season of The Sopranos, where Hesh is essentially, he's going to get sued by this rap artist who's claiming that he ripped off all these people. Morris Levy, you know, he ran Roulette Records, a bunch of other record companies. We'll get to a little bit of that later. So Sharpton was well known for threatening these labels and concert promoters. And basically, when he would shake them down, they would then have to give a contribution to his group, the National Youth Movement, which was the predecessor of the National Action Network, which, again, we spoke about in the Roger Stone episode. Now, Currington, who's, again, the very nasty character, you know, a heroin dealer, mafia associate, and himself was, you know, ripping off a lot of people. He was actually the vice president of industrial affairs for the National Youth Movement. So, again, just to kind of bring everyone up to speed, because I know I'm going to kind of throw a lot of information out there. One of Sharpton's mentors is, again, this guy, Robert Currington. Again, lots of mafia ties and drug ties as well. That's another major sort of thing to keep in mind throughout this episode. Because, again, Sharpton's other cornerstone, along with supposedly wanting to better the black community and black artists, is stopping the flow of drugs into black communities. Now, let's not kid ourselves with what we have so far. We are now we're talking about a small group of Italian and black criminal elites like Bonanno and Currington and Morris Levy, who are essentially profiting off of almost predominantly black and Hispanic artists in terms of controlling the record labels, in terms of controlling their contracts, copyright, all that kind of stuff, while at the same time they are flooding almost exclusively predominantly in black and Hispanic neighborhoods with heroin. Currington, very involved in this. Bonanno goes back to heroin trafficking, is how he kind of got his start. So if this seems, you know, like a contradiction or a bit odd, it's because it is. These are the people that the crusader, Al Sharpton, is associating himself with. The very same people who control the music industry, who rip off black artists, and at the same time, they are also selling black artists drugs, and they are selling drugs to the communities where the black artists are from. So keep that in mind, because that's an important kind of factor that's going to kind of come up again and again, and also goes just sort of towards exposing how shady and corrupt Al Sharpton really is. Now, back to his informant days and his knowledge of and connection to Pangano. This is very big with the FBI. Pangano purportedly controlled Sammy Davis Jr.'s music career and his contracts. He was getting he was involved in a kickback scheme with Columbia Records. He had once been offered the ownership of the Sands Hotel in Vegas, and he was also close to Rodney Dangerfield. who, I think everyone should know who Rodney Dangerfield is, very famous comedian. He's in Groundhog's Day. And Dangerfield himself was performed at Pangano's son and daughter's wedding. And Dangerfield himself is a sort of mafia associate in many ways. He was arrested also by the FBI back in 1955 after fraudulently securing Federal Housing Administration loans. He was a door-to-door salesman. He sold aluminum siding and was basically taking out all of these Housing Administration loans in his clients' names. Now, so Pagano was a big figure, and the FBI believed that through Pagano they could get to a lot of these other figures and possibly all the way up the top to Vincent Gigante and the head of the Genovese crime family. And the FBI was also interested in psychological. They were very interested in these rumors that Pagano was gay, that he had some sort of the smoking gun says that he turned gay while he was in Sing Sing prison. FBI was very interested in exploiting that. And Al Sharpton, who at this point was in the sort of informational phase, he was giving information to the FBI. He was explaining his connections. Sharpton told the FBI that Pangano was indebted to him after he brokered a business deal between Pangano and the recently retired Muhammad Ali. So Sharpton is giving them all this information, and presumably he's giving them information on Carrington, on Bonanno, on all of these figures that he has met now through the music industry and through boxing promotion and other stuff. So soon thereafter, Sharpton goes from an informational to an operational informant. So this means now that they're done sort of debriefing Al Sharpton on what he knows, and then now they want to kind of send him out there, see what information he can get. And again, the Genovese squad, this FBI-NYPD joint operation, they soon turn their eyes to Vincent Chin Gigante. Now, they wanted to gather – essentially what they wanted to do is they wanted to gather enough information to get a wire. And Sharpton was an important role or important part in this puzzle in terms of getting that information. Now, the Genovese squad was also, again, as I said, interested in Morris Levy, who I'll give a little bit of background. He founded the Birdland Jazz Club, Roulette Records. As I said, he stole songwriting credits from R&B artists. He also, interestingly, held a large stake in Sugar Hill Records, which was a rap label owned by Curtis Blow, which represented the Sugar Hill Gang and Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. And we'll get to there's another Sugar Hill Records connection. So they were interested in these figures who, again, were very powerful and very, very wealthy. The record business, drugs, all this stuff that had made the Genovese and Morris Levy and others extremely wealthy. So the FBI and the NYPD, they begin to develop dossiers on many of Sharpton's mob associates. Now, initially, they would focus on Joseph Bonanno, who Pangano claims he introduced Al Sharpton and the two of them together, he formally introduced Sharpton to Bonanno. Now, Currington claims that he did it, but I think it's sort of irrelevant. It doesn't really matter. But after about 2 months into this research on Bonanno and the connections, they actually send Al Sharpton in. And he has an initial meeting between the two of them, set up by Currington or Pagano. And it's sort of uneventful. And again, it's recorded. Sharpton goes in with his briefcase and records it. And it's sort of uneventful. But, excuse me. I am just gassy today. After that, there are several more meetings and conversations, and they get pretty juicy after a while. And Bonanno would actually open up quite a bit to Al Sharpton, and this is something that FBI agents, mafia officials, media personalities, all these people will say that for all of Al Sharpton's sort of blowhard rhetoric and his image is sort of, yelling and whatever. He's quite personable. He opens up well to people. He knows how to talk to people of all different walks of life. And he's actually, you know, he can kind of, you know, convince you or put you into a feeling of safety or whatnot. And you begin to talk. Now, Bonanno would start talking about all sorts of things. He would talk about his rocky relationship with Morris Levy. And at one point, Levy accused Bonanno's brother of stealing from the record company. And he even ordered a killing. He ordered a hit on Bonanno's brother. And I don't want to get too off track, but that caused like a whole sort of hubbub within the mafia underworld. And because you're talking about all these different families and ordering hits on people, and they had to have like a mafia sort of summit and sit down. And eventually nobody was killed. He also spoke very candidly about Levy's association with Giganti. Now, this is huge for them, again, because they are essentially trying to build this case to bring down the Genovese crime family. So over the course of several months, Al Sharpton and Bonanno would meet about 8 more times. And again, talking about Pangano at one Bonanno at one point talked about Joseph Pangano's attempts to kill Levy. He talked about Levy's attempts to cut off ties with the Genovese crime family. And he told Sharpton there's only one way out, and then gesturing with a gun and pulling the trigger. He also spoke about his mentor, Carlo Gambino. He talked about loan sharking. He talked about numbers runners. He talked about a proposed African diamond deal. And he also even talked about Vincent Chin Giganti's alleged illiteracy. Now, I guess we should also just sort of pause, because I don't know how familiar people are with the mafia in New York and whatnot, but this was a huge no-no. Even if Sharpton wasn't an FBI informant, Giganti was so paranoid about getting caught, about wiretaps, about informants, about all this sort of stuff, that nobody was really supposed to be talking about any of the kind of specifics. This is how our loan sharking operation works. This is how we run numbers in, you know, Harlem and other places. They weren't even supposed to actually mention Giganti's name in public. If you were having a conversation with somebody and you wanted to refer to him, you were supposed to just rub your chin, you know, where he gets his nickname. So the fact that Bonanno is just sort of spilling the beans here is huge. This is especially too for someone as high up as he was. He was very high up. He was a captain or a capo within the Gambino crime family. He should have never really been talking about this stuff, let alone with an FBI informant. Of course, he didn't know. Now, the NYPD told the Smoking Gun, the NYPD that were involved in the Genovese squad, they recalled that Sharpton's recordings provided massive insight into how Giganti and Morris operated. And again, this was a very involved operation. Al Sharpton wasn't just some, you know, he wasn't like a two-bit criminal who got, you know, caught with some weed or crack or something like that, and they flip him and he gives them a little bit of information. Sharpton is prepped in advance. He is always handed the briefcase. He's not walking around with his briefcase. So when he goes to, say, meet Bonanno at a restaurant in Manhattan, he's prepped in advance. Then he arrives at the location and then, you know, goes, say, several blocks away, gets into a car with the FBI agents. They hand him the briefcase. He goes, has the conversation, and then he is debriefed afterwards. So not only are they taking what he recorded, but they're taking, you know, his perspective. You know, I'm sure they're asking him things about body language, what was the mood like, you know, any little things here and there. I'm sure they would, you know, and then again, these recordings are, they're listened to, they're transcribed, they're filed. This is a big operation. Sharpton isn't, he's not like a, you know, an informant at like a local police department. He's an FBI informant. This is a huge thing. And at this point now, they're really starting to sort of understand the intricacies of how the Genovese family works, how Morris Levy works, how the Gambinos work, and they're beginning to put together a pretty serious case. Now, amongst all of this, you know, in the midst of all of this, and this time when Sharpton is very busy recording Bonanno conversations, he's also pushing very hard to have a role in Michael Jackson's upcoming Victory Tour with his brothers. And Don King was actually involved in the promotion of the tour in the U.S. and Canada, and I think it was like a 75-city tour. Very big, the Victory Tour. And Al Sharpton, true to form, starts threatening boycotts, saying that Michael Jackson hadn't given enough back to the black community, that he hadn't given enough back to black artists, and you know he's threatening boycotts and protests and going to make a lot of publicity for Michael Jackson that he doesn't want. So Sharpton is then named the head of Michael Jackson's Pride Patrol, which is this community outreach program that is sort of slapped together at the last minute by Sharpton and a few others. And in Sharpton's autobiography, he states that he was given a budget of $500,000 to distribute free tickets. And he also claimed that he gave out donations in poor communities, that he hired lots of poor kids and out-of-work guys to work security in some of the states. And, of course, all of these allegations of extortion against Michael Jackson and ticket scalping start to emerge. And, of course, the Honorable Al Sharpton denies all of this, despite the fact that, yeah, he did sort of, you know, to use mafia parlance, shake down Michael Jackson. And I'm sure that he was, scalping tickets and whatnot. And it should also be noted that during this time, Al Sharpton is not really getting all that much money from the FBI. He's getting walking around money. They're not paying him the way they do now. You know, now if you're an FBI informant, there are a lot of FBI informants that basically make a living out of being an informant because you can get paid so well. There's a New Yorker article all about a couple of FBI informants who are involved in all these big terrorism cases, and they basically make a living out of being informants. So it's presumable that, you know, Sharpton was trying to siphon off money. And he was actually so broke that he actually had to ask Bonanno for money so that he could travel with Michael Jackson. Now, interesting to note also, Sharpton became so kind of close with the Victory Tour that the FBI got really freaked out when Michael Jackson was invited to meet Ronald Reagan at the White House, because now they have possibly a undercover, you know, FBI informant, possibly, you know, with recording devices walking around the White House, and they didn't want to inform the White House of his status, or they couldn't, so they freaked out, and eventually he never actually visited the White House, and who knows, that might have been a favor, that might have been Michael Jackson saying I don't want him there, but either way, that was going on. Now, Robert Currington believes that Bonanno was actually interested in getting involved in the Victory Tour, and that that's why he was sort of helping Al Sharpton out. And he also thought Bonanno thought that Al Sharpton could get a particular artist signed to a particular label. That's how Currington kind of describes this. Important to note that, you know, Al Sharpton's music mentor, Robert Currington, the heroin trafficking mobbed up record producer, had a very low opinion of Al Sharpton and was constantly making fun of him behind his back, and still to this day thinks that he's like an asshole. So again, you know, the great liberal crusader was not well liked by some very nasty people. So I think that should kind of give you an idea of what kind of person Al Sharpton really is. Now, at this point, Sharpton is gathering a lot of information, and of course, then that information leads to other leads, that leads to other possible informants, and there's now a slew of evidence that the Genovese squad has, and with this evidence, they were then able to actually go about and start wiretapping. So they tap a Genovese Capo car, and this belongs to Dominic Cantorino. They tap, and that in and of itself is like ridiculous. It's just sort of like a side note. It took them like three tries to actually bug Cantorino's car. At one point, I think the first time that they were trying to bug it, hotshot young FBI agent, goes in and he breaks into the car and he puts the wires and everything and hides them and then he leaves and he radios to his fellow FBI agents and he's like, mission accomplished. And they say, no, you were made, Cantorino is staring at you through the window. So, but they were eventually able to bug his car. I think it was a third time. They also, bugged Morris Levy's Manhattan office and his farm, and they, bugged the phone lines there. They also bugged, Vincent Gigante's mistress's Upper East Side townhouse. They bugged, I think it was two or three phone lines in that house. Now, through these wiretaps and Sharpton affidavits, they would sort of bring down Levy and Cantorino. I think Cantorino ended up going to jail for something like 20 years. Morris Levy got very sick towards the end of his life, and he died before he would see the inside of a prison cell. But several other high-profile mafia soldiers and captains would also be brought down by these wiretaps and affidavits provided by Al Sharpton. Now, while this was going on, there was actually a separate case against Joseph and Daniel Pagano. Again, these are other very good friends and mafia associates of Al Sharpton. And there was a case that was going on at the time that the New York Attorney General office was going after, and it was like their organized crime unit. They were looking into to the Panganos, and they actually cited Al Sharpton as an informant on their letters to get wiretaps. They cite Al Sharpton as the informant who told them that business is conducted in their homes, and Sharpton even gave them like detailed outlines of the layout of the homes and all this stuff, and they were able to get these wiretaps. And on these wiretaps, they're talking about all sorts of stuff, illegal things and whatnot. And interestingly, Joseph Pagano was actually caught at one point reminiscing with a friend or something about his about trafficking numerous kilos of heroin with Anthony Fat Tony Salerno, who was the Genovese boss before Gigante. And of course, we mentioned him last week in the episode. Fat Tony Salerno, of course, was a good friend of Roy Cohn, and Salerno is the guy who allegedly provided the $125,000 bribe that Roger Stone handed to the New York Liberal Party in order to get John Anderson on the ballot and ultimately splitting the vote and getting Ronald Reagan elected. So, again, not that these are all like the connections mean something necessarily, but you start to see that these people are all kind of connected. And of course, along with that, there's also just a wealth of other really incriminating evidence that would get both of them in a lot of trouble. Now, that investigation would then end 2 years later in 1989, and it would lead to indictments against five Genovese crime family figures. Now, only Daniel, his son, would actually end up in prison. Again, his father would die 2 months before the grand jury indictments. Now, all of the defendants in this, the five guys, they all pled guilty. So prosecutors never had to explore or get into some of the allegations that were in the indictment. Now, I bring this up because in the indictment, the New York Attorney General, they allege that Daniel – Pagano, the son, quote, solicited the use of a bank account of the National Youth Movement to launder money. So now we, now this is a whole other sort of issue. And again, I think this also illustrates what we spoke about last week in the episode, where all of this sort of weird money and weird financial practices were going on with the National Action Movement, which is the National Youth Movement is the predecessor to this. Now, if Daniel Pagano was using a bank account that was completely controlled by Al Sharpton to launder money, that's a pretty serious charge. Yet, surprisingly, Al Sharpton, who again controlled this bank account, is never formally charged, never brought up, and he's never addressed this at all. Now, again, I guess Al Sharpton doesn't have to unless somebody, you know, goes through the smoking gun article and the documents and points it out, but that's a pretty big accusation, and one that I doubt Al Sharpton would have, a good answer for. Now, I guess maybe we'll kind of pause here for a minute because we still have a bit more to get to, but I just kind of want to kind of build this out a little bit. But we have Al Sharpton. We have all of these recordings and whatnot, all of these associations, many of them which are antithetical to his perceived image, you know? And this guy is now on MSNBC. He lectures people all of the time about race relations and about drugs in minority communities and oppressing black people, black artists, all these things, while he was making a career out of doing this himself. Now, perhaps Al Sharpton would, if push came to shove, maybe he would sort of play along with the idea that, well, you know, right, but I was bringing them all down. But he's so cagey about all of this, and he won't admit to anything. So we can only kind of assume that he was sort of okay with this to a large extent. And this is, again, a very different Al Sharpton than we are familiar with nowadays. Just pull up a picture of Al Sharpton back in the 80s, and he, you know, is a very different man than who we see today. But these investigations would, you know, lead to lots more prosecutions, lots of people would be brought down. And interestingly, a lot of these mafia figures still speak highly of Al Sharpton, you know, which is like really odd, you know. I mean, the informants and, you know, rats and stuff like that are never really viewed highly at all by any criminal. You know, you don't have to be in the mafia to dislike a snitch, right, if you're a criminal. But he's surprisingly, kind of viewed not like negatively, but, you know, and I guess not favorably, but sort of like neutrally. And again, it would be interesting to see if some of these guys, like if Pagano had actually lived, right, and then went to jail and then found out about this, who knows? But it's interesting to kind of see that Sharpton is not sort of, you know, so looked down upon. Now there's a few more kind of tangents and other sort of parts to this that we'll explore a bit more in the second hour, but maybe we'll get to a little bit of it right now in the first hour right here. So after the victory tour ends, Don King actually urges Al Sharpton to get into concert promotion. I guess, you know, seeing his value, in terms of shaking people down for money and, you know, the boycotts and all that sort of stuff. And Al Sharpton declines, you know, and he says that he wants to travel, you know, the uncertain road of civil rights activism. This is the term that he uses all the time. He doesn't want the millions of dollars that would come to him that would, you know, help support his family and all this stuff. Again, he's the, you know, altruistic, wonderful guy who's just doing this for, you know, the good of the nation and for all oppressed people. That's, again, very important to understanding Al Sharpton. It's all about that he's the crusader for, you know, the unsung heroes of America, for the people that have no voice. This is the image that he's created. And it was shortly after again, his work in the Victory Tour and also his work as an FBI informant, that we start to begin to see the changes and the reinvention of Al Sharpton. And he wants to leave the music industry. He doesn't want to have anything to do with this anymore. And he wants to, go about becoming an activist. And this is also sort of around the time that he screws himself over with the Tawana Brawley case. And I'm not an expert on that. There's some great episodes that, again, Ed Opperman has done on the Brawley case and Al Sharpton's involvement in that. But that kind of sullied him, in terms of his relationship with law enforcement, at least in a public view. And that might have even kind of led to his sort of cutting off ties with the FBI. And I guess at this point, maybe they didn't really need him. And for all intents and purposes, Al Sharpton is now no longer really an FBI agent, at least from documentation that the Smoking Gun and others have been able to dig up. So now we have the sort of reinvented Al Sharpton as the civil rights activist. Now, I guess he had been that to a degree beforehand, but looking at his trajectory, he's the young preacher, then he's sort of the civil rights activist, but also in the music industry. But now he's going to shed all of that. He doesn't need the money, he doesn't need the fame, and he's going to ride the uncertain road of civil rights activism. And this is, I think, where is almost even more interesting than the Al Sharpton, who's the FBI mafia informant. Because to a degree, you have to kind of say, the mafia, for all of these sort of, again, the Sopranos and whatnot, the mafia is not like a nice organization, really. They do horrible things. it's really funny the way that so many like rap artists idolize figures in the mafia, and they idolize mafia lingo and mafia culture. And of course, it's the mafia that was the one that was ripping off all these black artists. It's the mafia that was selling heroin and cocaine to all of these black artists and to black communities. So it's very odd, and perhaps maybe Al Sharpton, wanted to kind of shed that image. I don't know. But so now we start to see the evolution. We start to see the new Al Sharpton. And Sharpton's activism would continue on with his friend Robert Currington. And it was actually Al Sharpton and Currington that would help Senator Al D'Amato get the endorsement of several black prominent black ministers when he was running against the Liberal Democrat Mark Green. And I think I briefly mentioned that in last week's episode, but Al D'Amato, very nasty Republican senator, who's a total shill, will do anything for a buck, and not a nice person, and it was basically, again, running against a liberal. And now we have Al Sharpton, supporting the sort of more right-wing Republican. And what's important about Sharpton and Currington getting these black ministers to endorse Al D'Amato is that D'Amato had just, a few months ago referred to residents of housing projects as, quote, animals. So very odd that Sharpton would be supporting this guy. Now, Al D'Amato, of course, won very handedly. And he would when he won, he would allocate a $500,000 federal grant to Al Sharpton and Robert Currington to establish an anti-drug program in Brooklyn. So, again, at this point, Currington has already been convicted of heroin trafficking. And now he's going to be named the executive director of this anti-drug program in Brooklyn, which is getting $500,000 from the federal government. Well, we'll continue this in the second hour. I know I threw a lot out at you, but sit on that, and I'll be talking to you very soon.
narcotics.
Freedom. Oh, yes. I like very much
radio. You're an American institution. American Freedom Radio.
Are you feeling embarrassed and stuck because you can't focus or concentrate? I have a confession to make. I spent years unable to think clearly, like I was in a fog. I was going through the motion, running my companies, and I hated feeling groggy and mentally sluggish. I couldn't get ahead like this. It's no secret, the powers that be want us dumbed down. Chemicals, fluoride, our brains are under siege, and we are experiencing lower IQs. But now there's a weapon to fight back and win. Introducing DNA Evolve, a revolutionary breakthrough in a category of cognitive enhancers called nootropics. I've been using DNA Evolve and couldn't feel better. For me, it works. It feels great to get things done again and get ahead. Try a free sample for yourself at DNAEvolveSample.com. That's DNAEvolveSample.com. Supplies are limited, so go to DNAEvolveSample.com right now.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100%.
Porkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Okay, everybody, welcome back. If you're just joining us right now, this episode, I have been talking all about Al Sharpton, the FBI informant, his time as an FBI informant, informing on mafioso figures. And just towards the end of the first hour, we were sort of getting into the transitional phase. And we're talking sort of, after the sort of big indictments against several prominent figures, this is sort of a takedown of the Genovese crime family and Gambino's and others and stuff like that. And talking about Sharpton's transition to the trailblazing liberal do-gooder civil rights activist. And I was talking about his help with Al D'Amato, racist Republican senator. And I mentioned that when Al D'Amato won, and he certainly got quite a bit of help from Al Sharpton. And if you don't believe that, as I said, D'Amato allocated this $500 federal grant to Sharpton and his friend Robert Currington to establish this anti-drug program in Brooklyn. And I said Currington, who was a convicted drug dealer, was going to be the executive director. And they were also planning on getting $750,000 in corporate support from 8 different record labels. Now, ultimately, this federal grant, this program would never happen. When the government found out that they were going to be running this drug program out of a church, they got cold feet, and the grant application was canceled. Again, it's very significant. And Al Sharpton was also the guy who, at Al D'Amato's request, convinced Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King's wife, to attend the Republican National Convention. There's this awkward moment where Barbara Bush comes up and shakes her hand and gives her a kiss. And so, very powerful political theater. And this is the new battlefield that Al Sharpton is getting into. Very interestingly, Sharpton never mentions D'Amato's $6-figure loan in any of his books, and he denies having ever asked for public funding for anything, because he doesn't want to have any strings attached. He doesn't want to have any conflict of interest. But so, again, very interesting that he denies basically getting what would amount to a payoff, I would assume, from Al D'Amato. Now, I had mentioned before the Sugar Hill Records label, which was, you know, partly owned by Morris Levy and some other mafia figures as well. And there's another sort of side to all of that, which I think, again, is really interesting, given Al Sharpton's supposed promotion of black music legends and whatnot. Now, in 1987, Currington and Sharpton were involved in a multi-million-dollar deal between Sugar Hill Records and MCA Records in Los Angeles. Now, and so they Sharpton and Currington put money into this. It was going to be this huge deal. Now, the owner at the time of Sugar Hill Records, Joe Robinson, was in a lot of financial trouble, a lot of his financial trouble resulted in him back in the day taking money from various mafia figures that wanted to get in rap music. So again, that weird sort of you have so many rap artists emulating mafia culture, while again, it is the mafia that is making money off of them and basically stealing a lot of it from them and at least controlling them as well. So, you know, very, very interesting sort of mindset to have in mind. Now, when the deal between Sugar Hill and MCA breaks down, Joe Robinson starts getting harassed very frequently by some, you know, very scary Italian gentlemen. At one point, Bonanno himself would pay a visit to Sugar Hill Records and attempt to get the money that Robinson owed Sharpton and Currington. And it was, you know, it wasn't just Bonanno too. There's lots of other guys, you know, would show up and they would harass Robinson. They would threaten Robinson. At one point, Robert Currington himself was down there harassing him, and he actually punched one of Robinson's sons and was arrested. And when he was arrested, he identified himself as the vice president of Sharpton's National Youth Movement. Now, Sharpton himself would also go down there to the studio to collect money. So, again, you know, maybe I'm reiterating myself. Maybe I'm kind of beating a dead horse here. But this is supposed to be this man, Al Sharpton, is supposed to be the guy that's preventing this sort of stuff from happening. Yet he is up to his eyeballs in all of this. I mean, he is beyond a hypocrite, in my opinion. And again, too, I mean, he's talking about getting drugs out, cleaning up the music industry, when all he can do is associate himself with all of these sort of people. And just a quick kind of note on Sharpton and his connections to the music industry, drugs, and his own celebrity. So Sharpton got a deal with MSNBC in 2011. A few years before that, 2009, Al Sharpton and convicted cocaine trafficker and hip-hop manager James Jimmy the Henchman Rosemond attempted to get Al Sharpton a Judge Judy-style talk show. So, you know, Al Sharpton would be, you know, a fake judge presiding over, you know, God only knows what, you know, the sort of lame-ass shit that Judge Judy and, you know, Mathis Brown, all these other guys do, which would, I think, would probably be a better role for Al Sharpton. You know, I would much prefer if Al Sharpton just sort of stayed in entertainment, you know, and if he had a judge show, I would definitely watch that. I mean, I'm sure it would be hilarious. But and just say James Rosemond wasn't just a cocaine trafficker. He was head of a massive, massive cocaine ring in California. So again, this crusader against all of these things can't seem to shake all of these nefarious friends of his. He continues to surround himself with all these people. Now, let's move on to another part of Sharpton's informant career, because for right now, what is Sharpton doing? He is basically informing on bad guys. You know, for all of the talk about how, you know, cool and wonderful the mafia is, they are essentially, you know, they are breaking the law. They are doing horrible things, killing people, extorting people, drugs, prostitution, loan sharking, all of these sort of things. So we can kind of say, well, whatever, maybe we can make the case that Sharpton is okay, even though I wouldn't. But the smoking gun investigation led very prominent black activist and black revolutionary leader Ahmed Obafemi to recall a very unusual meeting that he had with Al Sharpton back in 1983. And he remembered this meeting very well because Sharpton was acting very strange, and he remembered how Sharpton paid unusual attention to the briefcase that he was carrying, that he kept very close to himself in between him and Obafemi. And this made Obafemi very uncomfortable. At that time, there was, a lot of, Black Panthers, Black revolutionaries, activists were on the run. Obafemi and his friends were rightfully paranoid about informants and infiltrators into their groups. And he said that I'll link it up. It's in a Daily News article. But he said, I think he met two times and one time with the briefcase. And he said it was very odd. Sharpton wouldn't keep his – constantly kept his eyes on the briefcase. He talked about the way that Sharpton positioned the briefcase. He thought maybe there was a camera or a microphone in there. And he said that he was, totally vindicated when the smoking gun stuff came out. And he said what was even stranger was Al Sharpton's attempts at trying to find fugitive Black Panther Asada Shakur, who at that point was on the run. She'd broken out of jail. She was she now lives in Cuba under Fidel Castro granted her political asylum. And at some point, Al Sharpton ran into New York photographer and activist Kwame Brathwaite. And Brathwaite said that Al Sharpton offered to give Asada Shakur $50,000 if she could be located. And for anyone that doesn't know, Asada Shakur is the aunt of Tupac Shakur, very famous Black Panther. Tupac, of course, is like Black Panther royalty. So, his mother, father, his aunts and uncles are all very prominent Black activists, which is ultimately what led Tupac to being murdered. But that's definitely another podcast or a radio show there. So what is that? That is Al Sharpton also informing on other Black activists. Again, this is supposed to be the liberal crusader, the guy who is going down the unknown road of activism and trying to help all these people. And again, 1983, this is just when he is at least officially flipped by the FBI. And now he's meeting with very prominent people in the underground. So what's that about, and it makes sense. I think that, again, this is why Al Sharpton, or, Confidential Informant 7, was so sought after. I mentioned early on in the first hour that he was shopped around by his handler, Spinelli. And that is true. Anytime there was somebody needed some information or they needed somebody that could, sign off on an affidavit saying that, yes, at this particular restaurant or this social club or this house, business, mafia business, organized crime business is discussed, they would all go to Al Sharpton. And presumably Al Sharpton had, he may not have had connections to the Black Panthers in any tangible way, but he certainly would have been able to solicit that information if he wanted to, as evidenced by his meetings with Obafemi and also with Brathwaite. So now again, we also have and I think this is in many ways is maybe more nefarious in that, now Sharpton is really kind of just putting the cards on the table. It's bad enough that he hangs out with all these figures who are oppressing Black people, But now he's also trying to solicit information from actual activists, true people who are truly concerned, you know, with the plight of people with no voice. So very, very interesting. And again, this would have never come out had the Smoking Gun not did this big investigation into his work as a mafia informant. Now, I guess presumably we could probably get a FOIA request and see if there if there's anything to Obafemi's claims. There should be a paper trail. There should be something that identifies. It may not identify him as confidential informant 7. It may not. And this is also very important. I forgot to mention early on. The FBI did everything that they could to hide who CI7 was. The specificity with which CI7 talks about events and whatnot in these affidavits, if these cases ever go to trial and defense counsel, you know, they have the right to all of these affidavits, to wiretaps and whatnot, it would take them about 2 seconds to figure out that they were talking about that it was Al Sharpton. There's, you know, no way around this. And the Smoking Gun links up in their documents. They link up a draft FBI affidavit, which, again, very clearly lays out that CI7 is Al Sharpton. And again, this is, you know, just by the nature of the what was talked about in the conversations, the location, all that sort of stuff. And the FBI would actually go back and they would rewrite the affidavits to hide who Al Sharpton was, to hide who CI7 was, to hide any specific things that would lead people to seeing that he was walking around with a briefcase that was wired up. So the briefcase is never mentioned. In one of the affidavits, some Gambino wise guy that he's talking to, that name is deleted. Again, all mentions of the briefcase are deleted. So again, this was a very this wasn't your run of the mill informant. This was someone that was well protected within the FBI. So, you know, something to definitely keep in mind. So again, even if we, you know, were able to get these FOIA requests, it might be difficult to ascertain exactly, you know, who the informant was. Now, also on this sort of note, again, of Al Sharpton informing on leftist groups and things like that, a good friend of the radio show, Ed Opperman, has spoken about his experiences with Al Sharpton. And when Ed was younger, and he was with the Yippies, he met Sharpton at Rock Against Racism, which was a Yippie event. And then he later met Al Sharpton at a planning meeting with Black Vets for Social Justice. He also met him at an event held by Reverend Herbert Doherty. I'm sure I'm butchering that, Ed. I'm sorry. And I actually spoke with Ed the other night, and Ed said that this was the first time that he met him was sometime after 1979, and the last time that he saw him was I believe it was sometime before 1985. So in theory, he had to have been an informant before 1983, and this is what Ed believes, that there's no way that he was flipped, you know, in that the FBI sting with the coke and whatnot, that he might have been flipped even before that, or he might have been, you know, they might have been leaning on him. And again, who really knows what's in that FBI video? Now, I know, you know, that's what we're all presented with. And this is sort of a, you know, tinfoil theory, but I mean, what if it was the other way around? What if it was Sharpton who was setting up that guy? You know, what proof do we have that this FBI agent, this alleged FBI agent, was the undercover officer? I mean, I don't know if that guy's ever going to come out. You know, I mean, these sort of guys, their identity is hidden. So, so Ed believes that Sharpton was informing on them. And again, I think it would make sense. Or at the very least, that's another avenue. Yippies were fairly radical. I believe, Abbie Hoffman was on the run. These were not, your sort of garden variety, white liberal activists. And Sharpton is hanging out there. Now, also, Ed, and I think Ed has also spoken about this before on his show, he met Al Sharpton again sometime around 1982 when he was working for a PI firm that did almost exclusively organized crime defense. So, this was a PI firm you would go to if you were an organized crime figure. Al Sharpton came into that office around 1982 and recognized Ed and was carrying his briefcase. again, he wasn't just going in there to, shoot the shit and hang out. There had to be more to that. What was he doing in that sort of PI office? What was he doing carrying the briefcase? So there is some evidence, as I said early on, that Sharpton might have been flipped or might have been working as an informant sometime before the official 1983 flipping, when he's busted for the cocaine charges. And again, this may not be like he was a full-on, FBI informant. He could have been he could be the sort of low-level informant, just given little bits and pieces of information here and there. But again, I hope I've sort of illustrated this to all of you, that this is a guy who, from at least the mid to late 70s, was involved with mafioso figures. We go all the way back to his time when he was working at Spring Records. He was at least involved in some sort of mafia-run scheme with Con Ed. And again, he's hanging out with all of these characters. I mean, it wasn't back in those days. It wasn't unusual for mafioso to come into the recording studios, to come into